continue with the ongoing saga of House Bill 763. Mr. Gardner, you're on. Again.
As usual, I have a little more paper.
I'm getting off of board and I'm showing my right.
Would you come up and we can buy some, we can get rid of you?
Rolled over.
Bastard over.
Well, Miles fell overboard and I went in the kayak to help him get out and then I was bailing out the kayak. And then it rolled over. They threw me a inner tube that had no rope on it.
My kid came home with one.
That's better than going to at all.
That's better than throwing your rope. It's probably short, isn't it?
Yeah.
They threw him a lifeline that wasn't tied to the boat.
It had an anchor on it.
That was what I must report. That was Commissioner Hubbard.
Oh boy, I'm gonna cut his butt.
All right, Mr. Gardner.
Mr. Chairman, at your request and some of the other comments were made, redrafted the amendments. The first one is the same. They're amendment number one. And amendment number two divides on page 9, line 20, that subsection 1 into two new subsections. And the first subsection is basically the same as my original amendment, but subsection 2 is a new one, and it basically says that in terms of loans for fishing vessels, either new ones or existing fishing vessels or repair or renovation of fishing vessels, must be owned by a resident or business venture which is wholly owned and controlled by a resident of the state. So we're not there. I don't think there's any loophole in this at all, that it's going to have to be 100% owned and controlled by either an individual or a group of individuals or a corporation.
Questions from the committee?
Is it possible to organize a co-op under this thing?
Yeah, co-op, corporation, joint venture. Any corporate form would, but it would still have to meet the same qualifications. It would have to be resident.
Yeah, but there's a hell of a lot of different ways to pay taxes in a co-op than you do in a pure corporation. Isn't that right?
That's true.
Yeah, they get tax breaks where for instance, PFI, they had to compete with a cooperative, they would have a hell of a lot different tax basis. It makes a lot of difference in their competition. Not the cat was a good example of their salmon pack going on the salmon exchange and competing with those that pay the ordinary taxes that required of them. And I don't think that's right. You're talking strictly of an Alaska-owned corporation. There's only one in Alaska. But you can organize a co-op and compete with those people, and you're using taxpayers' money. And that disturbs me no end.
It seems to me that the question that you have, that realistically we're faced is, the problem is we don't have any really fisheries co-ops and we don't have any resident corporations. And I think there's probably enough fish out there for all Alaskans. And the question is it going to be controlled by anybody in Alaska, whether they're co-ops or corporations? And it seems to me it's more Alaskans against other companies. Some people have argued the same thing about native corporations. They've got their land claim settlements and we shouldn't be setting up programs that they'd qualify. But to me that kind of begs the greater question that whether you're a native corporation, a co-op, or a corporation, it's still us against the foreign countries and the Seattle-based companies. And the reality is that we don't have even a foothold in terms of the processing. So if we can structure financing that would help every Alaskan, whether it's a co-op or a corporation, I think that's what we ought to do.
No, I think they ought to be on the same ground rules, as anybody else. They pay taxes and they employ a lot of people, and they're using taxpayers' money and going out of the market with the same product, and they've got a competitive disadvantage. percentage, you know? That's the thing that bothers me. I've been in several co-ops, I know what they're like, and every damn one of them that I've been involved in is like broke. But, there wasn't taxpayer money involved, so.
Any other questions or comments on the proposed amendment? Mr. Meekins?
Mr. Chairman, if there's no other comments, are you entertaining a motion on the bill?
If that's the desire of the committee, yes, Mr. Meekins.
So I'd like to incorporate the suggested amendments by Mr. Gardner. They're both typed, as I remember, so I'll just reference those and move that we prepare a committee substitute, 763, including those two amendments, and move it out of committee.
That's a motion.
Yes.
Is your objection to the motion? Hearing no objection, it's so ordered. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Gardner, did we have a, was there a question on a fiscal note for this thing raised yesterday?
Yeah, there, I wasn't here when that was. And,
Didn't we raise a question on whether or not we should, Mr. Rose, wasn't that one of your questions?
What?
That we should, whether or not we should have a fiscal note for this bill?
No, wasn't mine.
Maybe that was one of the others. I'm sure if we need a fiscal note, somebody will do it.
We'll take care of that for, there's a question on that for those of you.
Okay, let's have a look at House Bill 255.
Are we gonna protect ourselves from radiation today too?
Yeah, we'll get around. House Bill 255, Mr. Rowe.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20.
I see Freeman and Haugen and Meekins and Schaefer and
I'll move it out, Mr. Chairman, if you will entertain it.
Is there objection to reporting the bill out? No, it's so ordered.
Who's the prime sponsor of that bill?
Myself. Good,
you can speak on
that. It isn't enough money, but, you know what?
No, I'll give us something to do next year.
All right.
Okay, let's
need the line.
What bill are we running?
500,000.
45. This is a great bill. I got all the backup on this bill.
Senate Bill 49. All right.
Yeah, I ain't got it.
Everybody have a copy in the file of the letter to Chairman Cooper from Mr. Spanky?
No.
I even did lobbying on this bill so I could explain it a little bit.
All right, sure.
Do we have it in file?
No, it was passed down. Well, the idea here is that the old radiation equipment, when you get x-rays, the amount of radiation you get varies tremendously. And the old equipment gave you, a couple hundred times more than you need, and now the newer equipment is much more precise. But in any case, whether it's new or old, the equipment has to be monitored on a fairly regular basis to make sure that it's only giving you a certain dose of radiation. And evidently, we don't perform that function right now in the state. And so when you go in to get your teeth x-rayed or anything else, you're really not sure of how much radiation you're getting. And it's not only highly correlated with cancer, but I think it's lead by all scientists that radiation does indeed cause cancer and other very harmful effects. And radiation is cumulative, so the total amount you get, whatever you get, it keeps adding every time you get more. So it's very important to get small doses because of the tremendous number of x-rays and stuff people are getting these days. So it's just a protective measure, and evidently we don't monitor this area at all, and it's important that we do because of the great fluctuation in the number of rentgens that you might get in x-rays. It's just sort of it's real important to some people. It's not a major piece of legislation, but the people who talked to me made a pretty good case for it.
What do we have for a fiscal number?
My file's being brought up, Mr. Chairman. I think I have the fiscal note in the file. I'm not sure.
Why don't we stop x-rays and stuff? Get rid of it.
Well, it looks like zero to me. I'll move it. Wait a minute. Let's not switch. Then we're at 17.
Shoot, now I know.
44,000, I see. In the latest fiscal note, January 24th.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Green is on his way, and he's interested in this bill and has an amendment to the proposal.
Oh, he does have an amendment. Okay,
it's on
he'll be here shortly.
What do you mean on his way?
So is Christ.
On his way here or somewhere else?
His office said he's on his way.
Don't run off. Or else we all go.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to pass out some papers.
Mr. Chairman of a subcommittee to rework it and get it back to us.
It's a supplemental to corrections.
This is a proposed
House Committee Substitute for Senate Bill Number 45.
Okay,
I wasn't here. Okay, I see. This is a different thing. There's another section, 18, Chapter 45, entitled 18, which deals with the Atomic Energy Development, and it's a little-known statute. It's been on the books for quite a while, but it's essentially an agency that's, or it's a commission that's designed to promote atomic energy in the state. And I've got a few amendments to that, and I want to pass that out.
That's not the one that was passed about 20 years ago, is it?
Yeah, well,
almost.
Because after we felt guilty, but
I have a very funny story. I'll tell you about that sometime when there's no ladies present. John Rader and Giersdorf. Giersdorf was the first state legislature. Bob Giersdorf. He was really into atomic energy.
My dad must have been there.
And this was, let's see, it was on the State Affairs Committee. John Rader was chairman. I was serving on the State Affairs, and so was Giersdorf. Every day we had a meeting, Giersdorf had something about atomic energy. Anyway, again, I'll tell you this.
Well, maybe this is somebody's
pet project that got put in. But what we should have passed out is copies of the present statute, but it deals with the intent that we promote it, essentially. It also recognizes, this is existing now, recognizes some of the safety hazards, but it doesn't provide for any permitting by state agencies in these functions, and it doesn't really deal with the problem, whether or not the issue, whether how we want to approach it, whether or not we really want to promote it. Frankly, I feel comfortable appealing the total statute, but I do think we should have, to the extent that private agencies are going to develop it, we should have some overview, and this is what this amendment intends to do. What I prefer to do, Mr. Chairman, is to have the members look at it and maybe hold this bill one day. The Speaker has some interest in this, and it's kind of foolish to thought. Is there any objection to that?
Is there any objection to holding the bill over? I don't think so.
No.
Give ourselves an opportunity to clean ourselves with the proposed amendment.
In fact, we ought to get I guess we'd have a chance to look at the statute here. See what it is.
It's pretty short, actually. You can glance over it yourself and get the gist of it. I think this whole thing kind of developed out of a guilt complex, or at least some people wanted to promote peaceful uses to prove that this thing that we'd invented had some good side benefits. Period of time when it was deranged.
Well, I thought we passed this thing out according to me, 419, did we have a hearing?
No, we had a hearing on, but we didn't report it on.
Okay, if there's no objection, then I will
hold this
over and leave. Mr. Meekins, did you
Well, they're making copies of it, but we can do it another day if you want to adjourn now. Otherwise, it's probably going to be 2 or 3 minutes, 5 minutes.
Okay, I tell you what, let's do. Let's
it's not.
Let's wait 5 minutes and then don't meet in the morning. How's that? Doesn't that sound like a
good call? What bill?
What
are we waiting on?
Yeah, we could.
Let me get the fiscal analyst in.
What do you mean?
It's a correction supplemental that's been hanging around.
Get this thing out of the way, and we don't have to come in through tomorrow afternoon.
Chairman, remind me, Mayor, we had a night meeting here, and it was on the budget or something. And Helen Byrne came in with Houston, and they talked about two different bills. And this one was just a little about 5 or 10 minutes of testimony was taken. Mr. Cooper asked them a couple of questions. It looked as if they didn't really have their act together. We looked into it, and the situation is, you won't believe all the things that have changed since this original bill was introduced. I can find a copy of the original one.
Here. Actually, there didn't do it in February.
Yeah. Okay. Now, the original bill had a $43,934 payment to the city of Anchorage, which is what the Chairman Cooper asked about, because he had a memory of having paid that. And $68,000 for temporary positions, $17,000 for Bethel jail services, $130,000 for Nome, and another $45,000 for Bethel, $162,000 for out-of-state federal prison costs for prisoners that are out-of-state, and $6,700 to the parole board. Now, we looked into each one of these very carefully and found some amazing things. For instance, the $43,934 had already been paid, completely already been paid, and the department admitted that, and not only did they admit it, they wrote a letter to us apologizing for putting it in, claiming it was a mistake, and they just misread their own records. The funding for temporary positions, we reduced that because they're asking for six positions when they only really need five. What they're trying to do is man a post. I think they call it a post, and you need five people to man a post. And for some reason, they asked for six, and so we, The common thing is 5 years. We've always budgeted that way before. We did it, in fact, in this budget, so we cut that back to 5, which ends up being $56,700. Now, in regards to the Section 2 in the original bill, the $17,384 for Bethel Jail Services was also included in the $45,000. So that was another mistake that they've made. That they had two things to Bethel. One was 17, one was 45, and it was really just double counting. 17 is included in the $45,000. Now these two costs, the Nome and the Bethel, arose because the state originally was contracting with the cities there to provide the jail services. And then for one reason or another, those contracts were changed and the state took over the administering of those services. It's now run by the state. Because of that change, they incurred extra costs. And so we looked into these costs and we've changed their numbers around significantly again. And they agree with these numbers now. But they just had some more inaccurate calculations and various things. So we found, essentially, $30,000 that was there that they didn't need. So for the Nome Jail Services, we now have $101,287 instead of $130,449. And for the Bethel Jail Services, we have $43,069 as opposed to $45,000. Now for the fiscal year 78 out-of-state federal prison costs, we have 124 prisoners currently incarcerated outside the state, the Federal Bureau of Prisons. We reimburse the Federal Bureau of Prisons for those prisoners. What they have planned on doing is increasing that number to 145, and I'm vehemently opposed to that. I don't think that it was a good policy in the first place to start sending prisoners outside. There's no real need for it, as far as I can see, and the people that I talk to don't think there's any need for it. But I really don't think we can get into the policy of whether we should cut them back or not and force them to return, but I really don't want to let them increase the number because it started with 35 prisoners. They probably can make a case for maybe 20 that need to be outside, and they've just been having a general policy of shipping people outside to these large institutions outside where people do some real, you know, weird things. So I don't really think it's necessary. So what we did was we kept it at 124, just status quo, didn't allow them to increase to the end of the year to 145, which amounted in a substantial savings. The number for that would now be $82,883, reduced down from $162,600. Is that correct? Yeah. Okay, now the $6,700 for the parole board, that we kept that in there. That number had already been reduced from a $27,000 request from the parole board, so that was a minimum amount I didn't think was possible to cut that, and I think they needed it. It's basically for travel for the parole board, and they have to have it. We did make some additions, that are suggested to the committee in regards to the work that I'm involved with in Senator Sackett in the master plan. I talked to Senator Sackett, and he thought that putting the money on this supplemental might be the best way. We have contracted with a consultant, and we're going to need some extra funds in order to fill that contract because we've asked for extra things. We've gotten $164,000 from the federal government, and the state has to come up with some match for that. Not all of it. We don't have to come up with as much as we're asking for here, but in order to do the job correctly, we need a certain amount of money, and this just makes the total what we need. And that total, that we'd have to add $81,250 to the $164,000 that we have in order to complete the master plan. The only interesting thing about that might be that because the master plan process goes on until next December 31st, we have the lapsing date December 31st, so that we don't have to put it in two different sections and all that. So we just let the contract. The other part that we've added is $27,238 to the Division of Corrections to update their database. It's necessary to have data in order to do any kind of projections about what kind of needs, what your inmate population might be. They started this process, and what essentially it meant was going back through all the handwritten things and computerizing them and then cross-tabulating stuff, and they need another $27,238 in order to bring it up to date. It's now up to 1977,
I think, through the end of the year of 1977. They want to bring it up to date, and this money would do that, as well as provide some for some other kinds of cross-tabulations and stuff. So that would be my recommendation, would be this, all the sections included on this piece of. And we have saved a lot of money in the process, even though we've added some, we've saved some too.
Questions from the rest of the committee? Mr. Shaker.
Just curious, are these people that are sent out of state, how do they come up for parole, or who do they see? Do they see the parole board, the board of the state of Alaska, or do they see people?
State parole board.
They're under the state's jurisdiction as far as parole or anything like that goes.
These people come out to
the parole board, travels to those eight.
That's what, to the 6,700, that's part of what that's for. My feeling, and we can get into that sometime, my feeling is it's generally a bad policy to send people out of state unless you have to.
Further comments or questions from the committee?
Mr. Chairman, if there aren't, I'd move for that we adopt the proposed committee substitute and move it out of committee.
Is there objection? Hearing none, Mr. Ward.
Yeah, it does. Years and years ago, I had like 15 people out there. Now we got 124. That's a problem with 25% of the whole system. Oh, you got more?
Just a short.
Well, as soon as we get the report signed, I should remind the committee that according to the schedule the chairman provided me, tomorrow at 1:15 we will start hearings on capital loop finance.
I think I got to be in anchor.
You're a prerogative.
Well, I'm ready to move.
I don't write the schedules, I just read them. Okay, did we get all the signatures on that? If we have, we'll adjourn until 1:15 tomorrow.
Meeting come to order. The purpose of the meeting today is for the committee to begin to familiarize itself with the capital move issue and the bonding flow from the resolution of those issues. The bills upon which we will be asked to work are still in the State Affairs Committee. They've been there since the first day of the session. Of course, it goes without saying that it'll take a long time for people to familiarize themselves with what we're dealing with here. And I don't want to delay the process, that process any longer than we absolutely have to. So we're not bypassing the State Affairs Committee here today. We're taking our first licks. And I know a lot of questions will come up over the next 3 days that we can't resolve in these hearings. Have to ask for more information, and we'll have to continue to have hearings. But if we wait until the State Affairs Committee finishes and then start from scratch, we may be here till October. So I don't think anybody wants to do that. Normally, I would have hoped to start with the Capital Planning Commission, but unfortunately, the schedule was not set in that order. And it's my understanding the Capital Planning Commission has other things to do or is otherwise committed until 3:15. They will be here at 3:15. So it's a little out of order to take these other witnesses, but nevertheless, we are going to do that. I think, in my opinion, in any event, there are at least three key issues that this committee has to address, and I would suspect a score or more of others. One issue, of course, is the number of permanent state employees that will have to be shifted to the new capital site. There is a study going on at this time that has to do with that. And certainly this committee will be interested in going into that. We don't want to create a duplicate form of government, I don't think. There's probably a very thin line there. Secondly, the rate of inflation and construction costs. We're going to have to meet that question. And thirdly, the rate of government growth and how that's to be reflected in terms of capital expenditures on the new capital site. We have with us today a representative, two representatives of the William Blanchard Company, and they've been retained by the Division of Legislative Finance for the purpose of looking into some of these questions. So, Mr. Hogan, would you like to go into a description of this additional data that we have?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. My name is Jay Hogan, Director of Legislative Finance. Every member has before them a red-colored booklet that constitutes the bulk of the documentation we wish to present to the committee. And I thought if I might take a few moments to go through the book briefly so you know what all is in there and what the central purpose of this particular study was. Basically, William Blanchard Company was retained to provide a cost estimate for the construction of new capital based on the assumptions given to the Capital Site Planning Commission. In other words, city of 30,000 later turned out to be 35 to 37, but essentially following the exact same requirements given the Capital Site Planning Commission by last year's legislature. So their whole focus has been to do just that. Other materials that came to our attention are appended as attached. The memorandum that opens the report summarizes the various enclosures and the findings of the report. There is a summary cost sheet, which is about 4 pages down, which gives the total construction costs as estimated by Blanchard. Behind those are various backup sheets. We broke the study into essentially three types of costs. We had costs of municipal buildings, we had costs of state buildings, and we had costs for utilities. Each of these spreadsheets behind the summary total presents those specific costs and specific types of facilities. Beyond those charts, there's a document labeled Attachment A. This contains all the assumptions that the contractors used in doing their price study. It contains the population data, the workforce data, the scheduling for the move, the types of facilities to build, all the material, all the decisions, if you will, they needed to have in front of them to know what it was they were pricing. All of this information, by and large, came from either the Capital Site Selection Committee or the Capital Site Planning Commission reports and documents. The method used by Blanchard was different somewhat from that used by the Capital Site Planning Commission, in that, as you see by reading through the attachment A, you'll see that specific existing buildings were used as models. For example, the Auk Bay School, the Richardson High School in Anchorage. These buildings were taken as built plans were provided to the contractor, and they'll go into more detail about how they arrived at their pricing for building. Basically, they were working from buildings constructed in the state of Alaska. We tried to make them recent buildings, say within the past 5 years. So that's how the cost, how the particular models for cost were chosen. And the first tab section, falling behind those beginning documents, is entitled Capital Site Cost, Capital Site Planning Commission. Here we have the two summary sheets presented by the Capital Site Planning Commission. The one in early January, which presented the costs of the new capital at the 10% escalation figure. And then the one that the summary sheet that provided the information of 8%, which is the report actually presented to the legislature. The January 9th report was a draft report, if you will, and the January 25th is the official version financing plan that was presented to the legislature. But the two versions, one at 8% and one at 10%. Beyond that is a section labeled construction costs. Through a variety of historical, there are firms that specialize in the preparation of data on construction costs. We have three or four here presented that provide historic cost, construction cost escalation for Anchorage and for Fairbanks and for Alaska as a whole. To give some idea of the historic rate of inflation, if you will, that you, Mr. Chairman, pointed out, this is a central question. What is an appropriate rate of inflation to use as far as construction costs are concerned? These tables give some bearing on that. The consultants have done additional work in addition to these tables that will help address that question further. Also included in there, in this write-up, is mention of two specific projects that could conceivably, major construction projects, that could conceivably go on at the same time that the new capital is constructed. One being the natural gas pipeline, and the other being the Susitna project. The significance of these is explained somewhat in this introductory memo, construction costs. Namely that Alaska is a small state. Large projects of this magnitude can be assumed to have significant impact on things like construction costs, so that when the committee is considering a major project like the relocation of the capital, it is appropriate also to consider other significant projects going on in the economy, or likely to go on in the economy at the same time, since they will impact the cost of any construction. The next section contains the Attorney General's opinion, as requested by the Speaker of the House. It's included here for reference, specifically on the point that there's some question, and I'm sure the committee would want to hear further from the Attorney General on this, there's some question as to what the legislature's prerogatives are in this unusual circumstance in view of that initiative. As I say, I would expect that the committee would get into the issue of the initiative and the Attorney General's opinion on that at some time when the Attorney General is present. The Budget and Audit Committee, the next tab, labeled White Weldon Company. The Budget and Audit Committee commissioned a study done by White Weld that addressed the question of the ability of the state to finance the relocation of capital. That study, it's only 6 pages in length, final report, is included in the pink copy attached to that tab. And essentially, the I suspect that White Weld would be available for comment and discussion of this at a date, should the committee so choose. One item of particular interest in the tab labeled Federal Receipts. In the Capital Site Planning Commission report, there are some, as the write-up says, there's some $53 million worth of federal receipts that are anticipated that I believe were at one time described as additional money that would be available. On checking with the congressional delegation, letters from the various, from the two senators and the congressman are enclosed there. The facts of the matter appear to be that additional federal money coming to Alaska is not to be anticipated. The chart enclosed at the very end indicates that the state of Alaska already receives approximately 3 to 4 times as much per capita in federal aid as the average or the median state. The congressional delegation anticipates a reduction in federal money, the possibility, the extreme possibility of a reduction in federal money accruing to the state, and in no case do they anticipate an increase. So this is something I would presume the committee would want to keep in mind as they're considering this. What it really means, boiled down, is that if federal monies go to the new city for construction, they will come from some other location in the state. Finally, there was an item included to draw attention, if you will, to some of the problems of new communities. The federal government has had a new communities program in existence since 1968-1969. It's the last tab bit of information. They were new communities located in the vicinity of major metropolitan areas, major metropolitan communities throughout the United States. The history of those communities is included here, and it makes interesting reading from the standpoint that some of the problems of developing new communities, front-end money requirements, problems with escalating rates of construction inflation, and so on, led to some of the problems experienced by these new communities. And to do a proper job of analyzing the financing requirements for a major item such as a new community, you really have to be aware of some of these problems. Mr. Chairman, that briefly runs through the types of documents that are presented. Many of these would be much better. Many of these portions would be probably more appropriately gone into at later times of the hearing. I think what the committee perhaps would like to do now, I would introduce Mr. Blanchard on my right, Dick Blanchard. He is the president of Blanchard Construction. And I suspect that the issues that he is most able to address are the cost charts that were prepared at the front of this report, and the issue of, if you will, what constitutes a reasonable rate of construction escalation. So without further comment on my part, unless there are some questions, I would turn this over to Mr. Blanchard and Mr. Sisko, who is a project manager.
Before we do that, Mr. Hogan, there are a couple questions that I have. Referring to attachment A, which is the estimating assumption, who drew that up? Did legislative finance draw that up? Or?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Do you remember right offhand, I don't, what the square footage assumed for the court building in the new Capitol was? Maybe some of you guys, people in here from the state of Bear, do you remember right offhand what the square footage was? Do you remember, Tim?
It was about 213 square foot per employee.
Unless you know the number of employees, and then multiply it out.
Well, under which scenario?
I don't know anything about your scenario. I know that there was supposed to be a court building in the new Capitol, and I'd like to know what the Capitol Site Planning Commission came up with in terms of square footage.
The reason
I'm asking is that it strikes me that it might not be necessary to build a building that's as large as the one in Juneau, but here you're taking care of the litigation that takes place in Juneau City itself. It's not just just governmental litigation, and of course the Supreme Court would have to be moved, and certainly the law library and other facilities would have to be go, but I don't know if you need that much space, and that was the reason I was asking.
Mr. Chairman, that was in the study before you, the assumption was the juvenile court and office building with provision for Supreme Court space. The rationale behind that was that Chief Justice was reported as making the statement that at such time as government relocated, the court should give consideration to combining its facilities at the new Capitol site. That is the assumption that was used in this particular report.
Okay. Well, we'll look at that later. All right. Are there further questions, Mr. Hogan, Mr. Green?
Well, this may be more properly addressed to Mr. Blanchard, but you're figuring inflation on the cost of construction. Is it like a mortgage on a house? Do you amortize it over the time period in which construction is to be completed? In other words, is it 10% per year against the total figure, or do you figure that you're going to have half of it built by a certain time? I mean, it seems to me you schedule your inflation against what is already, hasn't been completed. But I hope that Mr. Blanchard can enlighten me on how these things are arrived at.
Maybe Mr. Blanchard would be the appropriate person to address it to, Mr. Greening.
The thought was that maybe if Blanchard and Mr. Sisco could take you through one of the ways they had arrived at a particular building cost, and then they would, I think, probably address that specific question of inflation after that presentation might help answer a lot of questions really before they
ask. Okay, Mr. Green.
Of course, where we're talking about a number of buildings, I guess it's important as to whether they're built simultaneously or in sequence.
All right, Mr. Kelly.
Yeah, Jay, I got a look at this report. It was something of a surprise to me. Of course, I didn't know anything about it, as most members of the legislature didn't know anything about this report. And I'd certainly like to have time to study it before I were to remark on it. I would, however, be interested in knowing just how this report came about. The only thing I know about it is what I read in an Associated Press story this morning that stated that you decided last summer to commission this study. And it seems to me, since the legislature had already commissioned the Capital Planning Commission to do the study, but I was somewhat shocked that you would take it upon yourself to...
Mr. Killing, Chair is going to rule your questions out of order, sir. You're not a member of this committee. You're certainly invited to sit at the table. If you have questions that relate to the matter here, you're welcome to address them, but you're not welcome to sit at the table and attack the motives or anything else of this report. If your question is how the report was originated and who asked for it, that's a proper question. If you'd like to ask that, please do so.
That is my question, Mr. Chairman, right. And that's what I would like to know.
Mr. Chairman, at the time of decision to do this, your committee will recall we had a capital projects planner budgeted last year, and I asked members of the committee to provide me with projects of interest to the legislature to have this capital projects planner or consulting firm, whatever, address during the interim so that we could have this information available for this session. There were no specific projects provided. As a result, at this particular time, I knew that the executive branch did not plan any sort of study on the cost of a new capital relocation or construction of a new capital. I was not certain that the Capitol Site Planning Commission would, in fact, be able to accomplish this within the time. And having the funds for a capital site projects planner, if you will, it seemed to me that the only project that I could logically see being planned, being caused, was this one. And as a result, I made the decision myself. I did contact leadership of the various committees, not from the standpoint of asking for anyone's blessing, but simply to let them know what I had in mind. And that's essentially the decision of mine.
I might add that that my recollection is that almost every member of this committee knew that this was taking place, and furthermore, it's a common practice to bring in several sets of experts to testify on important matters. We have, for instance, through the years, retained several oil and gas consultants. For instance, not just one, but two. We found. And on occasion, three and four. And we found that the byplay between those two sets of people allows the legislature and this committee to make much more informed decisions, particularly in an area that involves a great deal of money and a high-level policy decision that will affect the interests of people in the state for a lot of years.
Mr. Chairman, one further item, if I might address that question. The whole budgetary analysis scheme is, in fact, redundant. The governor has a budget office that does exactly the same things for the governor that we do for both finance committees. The argument is essentially the same. Why do we need two budget officers? We have one for the governor and one for the legislature. It appears to be an overlapping jurisdiction. The thought, I assume, behind that is that there are different points of view. The executive has a certain point of view and a certain style of presentation. The legislature has its point of view. That's, I presume, why we have two offices. And that's, so it's sort of built into the system that we have two viewpoints, or two looks, really, at most budgetary problems. Another thing that I would point to is that a project of this magnitude, it does appear to be fairly reasonable to have a couple of looks at it. One of the things that I thought was significant, I didn't realize this until we put the two reports together to bind it for the members, is that at the 10% figure, both the Capital Site Planning Commission and Blanchard came up with the same total dollar figure required to build the new city. It's $1.9 billion. So I think, if anything, there is a sense of confirmation about this that seems to me appropriate to be able to put that type of information before the Finance Committee.
Are there further questions of Mr. Hogan? All right. If not, Mr. Blanchard, how do you want to work this? Would you like for Mr. Sisto to come up also?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. If I could get him next to me, it would be helpful.
All right. If you would introduce yourself and give your
Chairman,
background and so forth for the record, we appreciate it.
My name is Richard Blanchard. I'm president of William Blanchard Company. We're builders and construction managers who specialize in commercial and institutional construction. Dem Sisco is on my left. He's an estimator and project manager in our company.
Can you give us perhaps some idea of your experience and what type of construction you've been involved in through the years?
Yes. First of all, we're located in New Jersey. Our company has been in continuous operation since 1860. We do a good deal of hospital work, of office buildings, variety of institutional buildings. I brought some material along with me about our company, which Mr. Hogan has. And are you distributing that now?
Yes.
I also have a folder of photographs of some of our recent and current projects, and some company brochures to pass around. whomever might be interested in looking at it. Perhaps we could get these started one way and the other way. We have not had experience, building construction experience in Alaska. Our activities are mostly in New Jersey. Three of us spent a good deal of time here last August. We were in Anchorage. We went to the Willow site. We talked to a good many of the local suppliers, subcontractors, the manager of the Building Contractors Association, and we've studied the local conditions in as much detail as we could in the process of arriving at our estimate. Mr. Chairman, perhaps the best way for us to proceed would be to look at the sheets entitled Cost Estimate in the folders, and we can begin to describe the detail of how we put our estimate together. I believe the first, these are the larger sheets that are folded over in the booklets. And the first one is entitled Cost Estimate Municipal Buildings. We prepared three separate spreadsheets, one relating to municipal buildings, another related to state buildings, and a third described, which is entitled Cost Estimate Utilities. The figures on those sheets are summarized on the other sheet that Mr. Hogan reviewed a little earlier. That sheet's entitled Cost Estimate Totals. In any event, we followed the criteria established in the document called Attachment A, which is also in the booklet. In most cases, we received plans and specifications for buildings that had actually been constructed in Alaska. And we did a detailed quantity takeoff of all the material and equipment and the labor costs related to them for installation of each building. We adjusted our unit prices on labor for the difference in the wage rates in Alaska for the various trades in contrast to the wage rates that we're familiar with in the East. And we got as much information from local suppliers and subcontractors as possible. Looking again at the spreadsheet entitled Cost Estimate Municipal Buildings. The left-hand column describes the kinds of buildings in our estimate. The first entry says elementary schools. The second column relating to elementary schools is entitled occupancy date. The first occupancy date listed is 1982. Based on the information that we were guided by from Attachment A, we estimated the first elementary school to be completed in 1982, the second one in 1984, the third one in 1986, and so forth down through 1994. The figures to the right of the occupancy date column, the 500 times 100 refers to 500 students per school times 100 square feet per student, which is the criteria we were given to work with from Attachment A. The next column indicates the square footage of gross area. That's 100 times 500 or 50,000 square feet. Going further over to the right, under 1981, we indicate a a construction cost of $5,014,000 for that particular unit. All of the figures in the first portion of this spreadsheet are based upon 1977 dollars. At the bottom of the spreadsheet, we have four lines indicating what the figures would be at various different compound escalation rates. The first line refers to an 8% compound escalation, and the second line refers to 10% compound escalation and on up to 15%. Those total figures are shown over on the right-hand column. That is for the total of construction for municipal buildings in 1977 prices, all the way over on the right, is $171,472,000. And if an 8% compound escalation rate were assumed, instead of $171 million, the figure would be $329 million. And on up to the 15% compound escalation, the same figure would be $594 million. We've prepared this kind of an estimate for three different general categories of construction. That is, municipal buildings on one sheet, state buildings on another sheet, and the utilities on a third sheet. Perhaps at this time I should dwell in a little more detail on how we arrived at each of the construction numbers that appear on the summary sheet. For instance, the first number on the municipal building sheet is the $5,014,000 for elementary schools. We used as our standard the Auk Bay Elementary School. Dan, could you pull out the estimate for that? We prepared our estimate in much the same way we do for lump sum competitive bidding. We have a summary sheet for this particular building, the Auk Bay Elementary School, and we have 20 some line items relating to various categories of the work. The first line item is site work for a total of $40,581. And we have the backup sheets related to the summary sheet for each estimate. There are three pages of calculations relating to the site work for that particular school. Going into all the detail we would for an estimate for competition for construction. The first item is 420 lineal feet of fencing. The next item is 40 lineal feet of guardrail. The next item, stripping approximately 1 foot of topsoil from the work areas, and we arrive at 3,200 cubic yards of stripping. We then proceed to site filling, as it was necessary for that particular building construction at Auk Bay, 2,838 cubic yards of site fill required. We then have an item of gravel paving, 3,351 square yards. And we go on through the excavation for column footings, 335 cubic yards. There's a quantity calculation for each footing. Excavation for walls and footings. Excavation for sewer plant. Allowance for a perimeter shelf. On through footing drains, backfill of footings and walls, and so forth. For each of the categories of work, we enter our own estimate on the summary sheet for each building. These are the net prices, in our judgment, $1,977. As customary in the building trades, a great many of the parts of the work are done by subcontractors. Wherever it was practical, we talked to and obtained figures from subcontractors who are familiar with the Anchorage area. I'll read off a number of them. Starting with site work, the next category is excavation. That again is based upon our own unit prices, upgraded and changed to reflect the Alaska price levels in $1,977. The next line item is concrete and reinforcing. The same kind of detail was used. Next line item, laminated beams. Next one, carpentry. Entrances and mats, roofing and sheet metal. We obtained a figure from Blatchford Roofing and Sheet Metal in Anchorage. Paving blocks, coat racks, toilet accessories, folding and movable partitions, ceilings and floor finishes. For both of those categories, we obtained information from Commercial Contractors Incorporated in Anchorage. Cabinets, counters, and shelving, a substantial item for an elementary school. Painting and finishing, that was our own unit. Our own unit prices updated for the to reflect the Alaska price levels. Electrical, we obtained budget information from Fishback and Moore in Anchorage.
Who are they?
Fishback and Moore. They're electrical contractors with an office in Anchorage, and they're a company with whom we deal a good deal in the East, too, so we had a prior relationship with them. Plumbing and HVAC, we obtained budget information from C.B. Lewis Incorporated in Anchorage. On down through miscellaneous iron, well and pump.
Would that be CR?
CR.
What did I say?
Oh.
I need to see beer.
We then add a line item for general conditions and administration of the project. Another line item for the insurances and social security taxes relating to our labor estimate. Then an adjustment for, as our judgment, for the efficiency of the operation at Willow, the mobilization and demobilization, for our own labor and material takeoff, and also for the subcontract prices, which were in large part based upon Anchorage costs. Then we add expected contractors, overhead, and profit as two separate line items. We include a design figure, which would normally not be part of the contractor's cost, but would have, to the owner, be part of the total cost of construction. We list 9% for design, including soils investigation. And we arrived at a total estimate of, came to $100.28 a square foot. We adjusted our figures to reflect the square footage of the school as it would be constructed at the Willow site. That is 50,000 square feet at $100.28 a square foot. That, Mr. Chairman, gives you an idea of the method we used for most of the estimates that we prepared. There were some situations that were different than this, but typically we use the plans for buildings that had been constructed in accordance with our own instructions on the attachment A, which is part of the material you received today.
Okay. What I'd like to do is maybe break at appropriate points and ask the members if they have questions, and that's pretty well covers your methodology.
Yes, perhaps this would be a good point.
Okay. Are there questions then on Mr. Blanchard's method in reaching this estimate? Ms. Buckle.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask him this question. In making a selection of a standard school and a model school, why was off day school selected?
We were not directly involved in the selection process. The selections were made by legislative finance and given to us. We did not seek out the particular building that we were to estimate. So I really couldn't properly answer that.
Would it make any difference one way or the other?
It seemed to us that this school was a fairly recent school, and it was probably representative of something that would be currently constructed. And whether it was in Juneau or Anchorage or elsewhere, we took that into account in the preparation of our cost estimate. It was a way of giving us a standard, which I presume was considered to be the closest standard to what might actually be done in Willow.
Uncle Jay has an answer.
All right, Mr. Hogan.
Mr. Chairman, specifically on the school, they were recommended to us by the Department of Education. They suggested the Off-Bay School, they suggested the Floyd Dryden School, and they suggested the Richardson High School.
Thank you. Mr.
Kelly. Mr. Chairman, just a couple things. First of all, there's a lot of concern in Alaska over the cost override on the Alaska pipeline. I'm sure your cost overruns on the pipeline. Capital Planning Commission indicated to us that on a project of this scope, where everything is broken down into buildings that are already tried and true, that the possibility of such an overrun like that is almost minimal. As a construction man, would you fear the possibility of large cost overruns above your figures?
I think it would be less likely than for the construction of a project like the pipeline. I think there are less uncertainties in building construction than there are of a project of that type. However, I think that the selection of the proper cost escalation rate is of paramount importance, because the figures are enormously different depending on your assumptions there. I think that is the greatest area of risk in determining whether it would be an overrun or not, particularly when you get into the later years, which are up to 1994, which would be, that's really crystal balling to determine what the cost levels are going to be at that time.
Okay, and secondly then, you've done if I understand this now, you took the Capital Planning Commission's personnel charts and population data and just built the buildings that they said had to be built.
There were a variety of criteria that we used, and the population of the office buildings did come from that source, yes.
So what we're talking about then is you costed out the Capital Planning Commission's numbers and assumptions.
Yes.
As far as actual construction.
Yes.
All right. Are there further questions on the methodology at this point? We can come back to it. If not, we'll answer you if you can.
Yes. I'm looking at the sheet entitled Cost Estimate Municipal Buildings.
which was the sheet that we began to review. We have a similar sheet for the state buildings and for the utilities, with a similar method in most cases used for estimating. The line entitled two-thirds of the way down the sheet on the municipal building cost estimate summary, there's a line entitled total 1977 prices, which is self-explanatory. We did not presume in this presentation to pinpoint what the proper compound escalation rate should be. We showed a number of escalation rates and felt that would perhaps be a matter of further discussion here. But the differences are enormous. For instance, looking at the cost estimate for the municipal buildings at an 8% compound escalation rate, the estimated construction costs through 1994 would be $329 million. And at the 15% rate, it would be almost $600 million. As a matter of clarification, the subject of our estimate included only what was viewed to be public buildings as described in Attachment A. There were a variety of construction costs that we did not include because that it was not part of our assignment. First, perhaps I should describe items of construction costs related to public buildings that could possibly occur, but were not included. We didn't have access to any definitive soil bearing data. We assumed soil bearing to be as it was described on the drawings for the buildings that we actually estimated. Now, if the actual soil bearing where the buildings were finally located was significantly different than that, cost would be either higher or lower. We did not include, for instance, the cost of dredging lakes for the public use at the site, which I understand from some of the literature is planned. We assumed the excavation and backfill and grading and site clearing for the buildings that we actually estimated, but we did not include any general site grading for large areas that would be unoccupied by buildings. There are a number of other things we didn't include because they were specifically excluded from the list. Items such as nursery schools, they were not. Skating rink, golf course, cross-country ski areas. We didn't include any of those costs that are not related to building construction, such as moving costs or cost of financing, that kind of thing. We assumed the cost of 10 miles of transmission line for electric service to the site, but we did not assume we assumed that the utility would provide the hookup cost. We included a transmission line and a substation at the new city. We didn't include anything like costs for citizens who would be relocated from Juneau to Willow.
Excuse me, I believe we have a question. Mr. Green? Yes, Mr. Blanchard, what are the criteria by which you establish when the schools should be built? For example, you have 10 schools with 500 students each,
yes,
scheduled over roughly 10 years, but let's say you were just looking for an eye to cost. Why wouldn't you say build two schools, only 2,500 each?
Well, we didn't make that judgment. Those were on the attachment A, which we were instructed to follow. It indicates the schedule for the construction of the schools. I think it's on page 31 or 33 of Attachment A.
Well, what, aside, just putting aside the attachment, what are some of the criteria? Let's say you had to provide for 5,000 elementary students. What are the criteria?
Well,
if you knew those students were going to be online, according to this schedule,
yes,
would it be better to build one school early or two schools evenly spaced or 10 schools? If you could depend on the students, because the attachment, I assumes there would be that many students filling the classrooms.
What? The information that we were asked to estimate was that the ideal school size was 500 students, and for an elementary school, the proper square footage per student was 100 square feet. So that we were asked to estimate units of 50,000 square feet, and the attachment A told us when each of those schools would be built, and we took it from there. We were not involved in determining when each of the schools should be built.
Well, my question goes to, let's just assume that you were going to have that many students then. In terms of cost, aside from what the assumptions are, would it be more reasonable to space it out that way, or to build one school early, even though a lot of it would be empty?
This is an intangible judgment, but a 50,000 square foot unit is large enough to be an economical one to construct, and I don't think that the cost would be significantly lower if a larger unit were built. The cost of construction, the one aspect of it that would be somewhat lower, is that it would be built at a lower cost level because it would be built earlier in the schedule when the construction costs were presumably lower.
Aspect outweigh the what I understand you to say, the diseconomy of building a bigger one big unit?
I think it's a combination of factors here. We were asked to estimate 500 student buildings, which was what was apparently wanted, and I don't think that it would be a really significant factor one way or the other. If you build a larger one earlier, you'd have the financing costs and the operating costs to carry a building that wasn't being used or was only being partly used. That weighed against somewhat lower construction costs. I really have not calculated that because it wasn't part of our assignment. I doubt whether there would be a significant difference.
Well, I just noticed the financing costs would have to be somewhat more than a compound equation. Mm-hmm.
And then you'd have to add the operating costs for a building that wasn't being occupied.
Well, I might point out that unless what we're doing is creating a state enclave here for the capital city, if it's in the Metsu borough, none of our affair anyway, near as I can see. We do have to pay, but Metsu Borough really makes those decisions. Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chairman, I might ask, the average, most of your cost estimates, were they computed from the Anchorage area?
Yes. It was, the assumption was that construction would be at Willow, and we used Anchorage prices and attempted to adjust them for the conditions particular at Willow.
Then, when you use someone, a building, maybe a new building from Juneau or a court building or something like that, did you allow for the difference between that area and Anchorage in your
application? Yes, we did. For instance, if we use the plans for a Juneau building, it was only to describe what the physical construction would be. We weren't using the cost data for what it actually cost at Juneau. It could have been, the building could have been actually built anywhere. It was
academic, whether it was Juneau or it could have been in Florida, then the estimate that you've given us are relatively
the
good estimates of the cost in that particular area.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Kelly.
Mr. Blanchard, on your escalation rate, given your figures of the Anchorage area being 9.1 and 9.6, you started out at 8% escalation and 10%, 12.5% and 15%.
Yes.
Why did you go to 15%? You've been using your own figures, isn't it? Almost, you know, unbelievable.
I'm a little puzzled when you refer to our own figures, the 9.1 and 9.6.
The Anchorage, the figures that I think are in this report indicating that past history shows Anchorage has been inflating it, construction costs have been inflating at 9.1% and 9.6%.
That was not our input. I'm not even familiar with those numbers. We have our own opinion about what it might be.
Let me rephrase the question here. Given the current and the past history of escalating construction costs, how come you estimated up to 15% compound escalation?
I think he just answered the question, Mr. Kelly, that he did not, that he was given those figures and asked to cost it out on that basis.
Oh, I'm
sorry. I think he's answering about the point.
We were requested to provide the mathematics for escalation rates between 8 and 15%, but that is not to say that we're not saying in these figures that it will be 15%.
Along that line, Mr. Blanchard, I'll let you use your own judgment on this. I would like at some point to go into some historical basis for the escalation of construction costs, and you might just let me know when you think that's appropriate. I don't know how long your presentation will be, so I don't want to butt in at the wrong time.
Mr. Chairman, I think it would be appropriate now. It seems to be the focus of attention. We could spend a lot of time going through each of the estimates, but it would really be the same methodology that I outlined to you for the Auk Bay building. There's a lot of that information, and this filing cabinet back here is full of it. That probably would not be useful to go into that kind of detail at this point.
I think it's the most, certainly one of the most relevant things in this committee's consideration of this legislation is what we're going to try to do is to estimate as best we can what escalation, if any, will take place in construction costs over the next 10 or 15 years. And I'd sort of like to find out from you what factors we should consider and what the historical trends are that you've spotted and what we generally should know about the question.
I'd like to preface our remarks by saying that we're building contractors and not economists, and I think that to project economic trends for 15 years is difficult for anyone to do, really. I'd like to first describe the historical data that we reviewed and then come to at least what our judgment would be. There are a number of companies who prepare construction cost indexes, and we studied six of them, actually. This morning we saw the presentation which the committee has, and that presentation includes escalation figures which were not prepared by us, by the Legislative Finance. But we reviewed them separately, and I have a list here of two different time periods and the escalation rates for a number of the different indexes. Taking a 1970 through 1977 period, the rates were fairly uniform. The average annual compounded escalation for the prepared by a company named Dodge for Seattle. Now they do not have an Alaska rate, so this is less significant. Approximately 9%. American Appraisal Company has a Seattle and a national rate. The Seattle rate was a hair under 9%, and the national rate was 8.44. The first Alaska index that we reviewed was the Beck Index. They had figures for three different cities: Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau. The 1970 to 77 period for Anchorage was an average compound rate of 9.7. Fairbanks was 9.1. And Juneau was between 9.0 and 9.1. There is a Marshall Index for the Western United States, which was approximately 8.5 for that 7-year period. There was a Mean Index, Means Company, M-E-A-N-S, for Anchorage, but that index does not cover the full 7-year period. It covers a period from 75 through 8. That's 9.9. I then went to a shorter period, the 1974 through 7, the last 3 to 4 years, focusing attention on the Alaska indexes. The Beck rate for Anchorage was 12.5, and for Fairbanks was 11.9. That's for the years 1974 through 7. Now, the figures were not presented in exactly this manner. This was our interpolation of the Means Anchorage rate. I already mentioned 1975 through 78, an average annual compounded escalation rate of 9.9. And another index called the International Conference of Building Officials, which is listed in the material that you have before you today, for the 1974 through 7 period was an 11.7 compound escalation rate on the average. I've been referring to a lot of different numbers, but the tentative conclusion that I reached was that if the 1970 through 1977 figures were used as historically significant, and if those economic conditions were also projected into the future, that the appropriate rate for Willow to use would be somewhere between 9.4 and 9.5. The 1974 through 7 rates for the last 3 or 4 years are closer to us, and in my judgment probably reflect more accurately what would occur in the near future. Those rates in the last 3 or 4 years, if the various rates are averaged, fall between 11.5% and 12%. What's going to happen in the next few years, I think, is very closely related to what other construction activity there is in Alaska. And of course, it's going to be affected to a degree by national economic matters too. I understand that with the gas project and the gas line project and the hydro project, that those are substantial projects which together would be as significant or perhaps even more significant than the effect of the oil line construction, which affected the last 3 to 4 years. So that for the near-term future, our judgment would be that a prudent compound escalation rate to assume would be somewhere between 11.5% and 12%.
Mr. Blanchard, leaving aside local inflationary factors like large construction projects that might take place or might not, for that matter, what factors in the building industry are there that are causing construction costs to rise as quickly as they have? And I think everybody that's bought a house or even rented an apartment in the last few years is knowledgeable about that fact. But do you have any thoughts on why that is?
Well, I can make generalizations, really. One of the major factors is the cost of labor, and the cost increases that are really built in to the labor agreements, which are already in effect, and don't show signs of decreasing cost. One of the other factors that's strong related to building construction is the amount of activity in an area. Though I think, Mr. Chairman, you asked me not to talk about that, but it does heavily affect the prices that contractors charge and the costs that they estimate, because when there's a larger volume of activity, particularly in an area that's not heavily populated, there's a tendency for costs to increase more rapidly than they otherwise would.
And what about the